Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast on this Monday. It is the Democrats' apocalypse now. I love this quote here from Politico. Moderate Democrats watched in horror as Bernie Sanders soared to a landslide victory in Nevada. The performance sent already worried Democrats into a full-blown panic. And there's this quote. In 30 years plus of politics, I've never seen this level of doom. I've never had a day with so many people texting, emailing, calling me with so much doom and gloom, said Matt Bennett of the center-left group Third Way after Sanders' win. It's this incredible sense that we're hurtling toward the abyss. I also think we could lose the House, and if we do, there would be absolutely no way to stop Trump. Today is the most depressed I've ever been in politics. So happy Monday. How are you doing? We're joined by my colleague Bill Kristol in our Bulwark studio. So happy Monday, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, Charlie. You know, my father was once asked, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And he said he thought most intelligent people, frankly, were pessimists, but he was a cheerful pessimist. So I think we should try for the next 20, 30 minutes to be cheerful pessimists.
I thought you were going to quote John McCain.
Yeah, it's always darkest before it turns pitch black. Yeah. But she always said with a laugh, so that was good. And look, I think fatalism and pessimism is actually wildly premature. What's one big problem we have is too many Democrats are looking at it. We've had less than 3% of the votes cast, fewer than 3% of the delegates selected. It's a little early to be sort of giving up. And so maybe they should not panic, not give up, and fight.
It is weird, although I am having the flashbacks to 2016, what happened in the Republican primary. But when you consider the numbers you just, and you tweeted those numbers out as well, the small number of people who've actually voted, the very small number of delegates that have actually been selected, and it is the sense of, well, it's absolutely inevitable now, right? I mean, it's going to be Sanders. Sanders is going to be anointed. Everybody needs to get out of the way.
Look, in 2016, it turned out that Trump was not stoppable later on, and the division of the field helped him a lot. And there's, God knows, there are similarities. Our colleague Tim Miller pointed them out. You pointed them out, and they're really true. On the other hand, to your credit, I'll just make this personal here. You fought much beyond the first 3% or much beyond the first 30% of the vote cast. You guys tried to build the wall in Wisconsin. That would be the moment where Trump's momentum could be blunted. And you beat him in Wisconsin. Now, it ended up not being enough. Yeah. It didn't translate to the next states. And there were problems with the alternatives we had to Trump. And maybe at that point it was late, but at least we fought. And I do think Democrats who are listening to this, whether it's Mike Bloomberg and Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, or whether it's donors and activists and voters, you got plenty of time. You have to have a real sense of urgency. We need to fight first in South Carolina and then on Super Tuesday and then every Tuesday. But, you know, the field will consolidate. It can consolidate faster if people do the right thing for their party and the country and put personal advantage aside a little bit. And it's not clear yet that a majority of Democrats want Bernie Sanders. It's not clear if plurality do. We just have had three states vote. So the key is to fight and fight with a sense of urgency.
Yeah, you have an open letter to the Democrats, which I want to walk through because I think it's a good it's a good bookend to Tim Miller's piece last week saying, look, you have 10 days. We said 11 days. And now it's down to less than that to turn this around. But I read my newsletter this morning. It's really hard to overstate what a gift all of this is to Trump because the Democrats had one job. All they had to do was to nominate somebody normal and make this a referendum on Trump and Trumpism. But they're really determined, it seems, to make it a choice between these two ghastly alternatives. And I think it's going to, some of the Democrats, I think, well, the centrist Democrats get it, but I think others underestimate how repellent Bernie Sanders will be, particularly once he gets completely vetted, how repellent he will be to some of these suburban voters that they had touted so highly in 2018, because let's be honest about it. I mean, you put Bernie Sanders on this ticket. If it's Trump versus Sanders, then moderation and a return to normalcy will not be on the ballot. And I just think it's so ironic, you know, after arguing the necessity of restoring American values and the rule of law, that they might be going with a guy who's lavished praise on communist governments that have crushed civil liberties. I mean, that's going to be a problem. This is going to be a brutal, brutal choice for a lot of Americans, including us, I think.
And I think, you know, I'm open to the argument that I think one has to be open to the argument that Sanders could beat Trump. There, a lot of things could happen. Trump's numbers remain underwater. People, Trump's a candidate of change and disruption, now having to defend the status quo. That's always awkward. Sanders is not a bad demagogue, just as Trump isn't. And so he might be able to persuade a fair number of Americans that his stuff isn't as dangerous as maybe it is. But for me, as I've thought a lot about this in the last week, as we all have, I've come more to the view that Trump is very likely to beat Sanders and could really beat him badly. It just feels to me, I was in college in 1972, so I didn't really follow that closely as a, you know, an adult or as someone who'd been through this before. But I do remember people ending up voting for Nixon, people I knew of, who hated Nixon. If you had told them earlier they would vote for Nixon, they hated him incidentally for 20 years. They just hated him for his first term of his presidency. And if you had told them these were traditional, you know, working class Democrats, that they would end up voting for Nixon, they would have said no, but the economy was okay. We were getting out of Vietnam. They thought, okay, four more years, not going to be great, but, you know, worst case, he'll get impeached. And of course he did. And I'm not sure we have that consolation with Trump, but that's another story. But you know, and McGovern, they thought, maybe a little unfairly, honestly, since he's much superior to Sanders, McGovern really threatened their economic well-being, really threatened the U.S. place in the world. I think that part was true. And so we would sort of prefer to sort of survive four more years of Nixon. I could see that thinking this time. If the economy's okay, we're not at war, people like you and me are extremely alarmed by what he's doing to our civic life, to our political life, to the rule of law and so forth. But people can sort of put that aside or hope the institutions hold, maybe vote Republican down ballot, vote Democratic down ballot. And I do think, I now think Trump, it could become a 72 type situation.
I do too.
Or 80. And you had thought about 72 months ago. I remember you put up, I think on your Twitter page, right? Didn't you?
I wrote a piece in Politico.
Yes, and then you had the image of someone saying Nixon's in trouble. Remember of Nixon being in, but your point was that Nixon looked like he was in trouble and looked like he could lose, and maybe could have, incidentally, if they had nominated Ed Muskie or something. But once that dynamic breaks in the election year itself, of this candidate is this challenger is too radical. That's Goldwater. That's McGovern. It was even in a lesser way Dukakis in 88. And I think it really can, it's very hard to overcome that.
You know, and part of the flashback, I think, to 2016 is the way that nobody's really laying a glove on Bernie Sanders. And you know that once the complete vetting and Oppo research drops, these numbers are going to change. So like last night in the interview with 60 Minutes, I was struck by a couple of things. Number one, he was confronted, and by the way, you know, credit to Anderson Cooper for confronting him with his lavish praise for Fidel Castro in Cuba, which has been a longstanding thing for him. And he essentially goes out of his way, doubles down on it, saying, you know, I don't agree with everything that Castro did, but at least he created this wonderful educational system, which is a little bit like saying, you know, Mussolini made the trains run on time. And I know people hate these references, but, you know, I mean, Hitler built the Autobahn, you know, these kinds of arguments. But also, when he's asked about all the free stuff he's giving away, leave the socialism beside. Let's leave the communism aside. You mentioned, you know, McGovern being a threat to prosperity. You know, people do feel pretty good about the economy right now. And here's a guy who is proposing $61 trillion in additional spending, and he doesn't come close to being able to explain it. He doesn't even try to explain, you know, how you're going to pay for all of the free stuff. So, I mean, there's a sort of unseriousness about this, and the fact that this fellow Democrats really haven't pounded him on that is I think kind of extraordinary.
It is, you know, Ron Brownstein, whom you and I know, very intelligent political commentator and journalist, doing this a long time, and has been right about a lot of things wrong once or twice, like we all have been. I mean, he's been pounding on this, just the amount of money, the promises Sanders has made. Americans, you know, there's a cynical view that Americans who like being promised free lunches, who doesn't, you know, but I think there's a kind of skepticism that's pretty well built in over the years about that, too. And you know, you can get away with it in a Democratic primary. You can get 30 or 40% of the vote. Even in the Democratic primary, there are some skeptics, obviously. But, you know, that's and they sort of discount, well, fine, he'll raise taxes and maybe it's promising. But I agree. I mean, people forget how much McGovern was hurt by that promise of $1,000 a person. I can't even remember exactly what it was. It just made it seem like he was just giving away money. and not serious about people working hard and earning, you know, helping them if they need a hand, helping them work hard and earn have a good job and move up in the world and so forth. But that is not the American way. The kind of handouts and just, you know, the free college stuff sounds great. And maybe if you are sitting there with college debt, you even and you feel like the system's kind of rigged against you, maybe you sort of it appeals to you for a while. But even then, I think people think, I don't know. I mean, can we just start forgiving debts? People have what about the people who paid out their debt? What about the people who didn't go to college because they decided they would have to make some money at first and would save up to go later? And their sacrifice is just worthless. I mean, I just think people are underestimating, the more I've thought about it, the degree to which there could be a rebellion, real rebellion in middle America against Sanders. And again, if the economy is okay, if we're not at war, people can rationalize a second term of Trump more easily than I could, frankly. But you know, just being analytical, I think they could.
No, this is true. And I'm trying to remember whether I've told the story before on the podcast, and probably I have. But I remember one of the turning points in 2016 was when one of my friends, who's an elected official in Wisconsin, was at a meeting up in rural Wisconsin. And he was listening to a Democratic state senator making the case for free college education. And he said, I'm sitting there and I realize they're going to get killed on this, because he's looking around the room and all the people in the room are rolling their eyes, looking at one another, because when they hear free college education, they think, you know, we have all of our problems, you know, running our farms or running our businesses and everything. And this Democrat is talking about raising our taxes so that we will pay for somebody else's kid to go to college. That's the way they interpreted it, as a giveaway. And he was absolutely right. Democrats got blown out in that particular area. So I think you're right. I think the free stuff thing has real potential to blow up. Not to mention, and a lot of other Democrats have recognized this, Bernie Sanders talking about taking away, abolishing private health insurance. I mean, that is a huge loser. And, you know, Medicare for all may poll reasonably well, but every survey I've ever seen, once you break that down and you explain that, it absolutely craters, not to mention all of other Bernie's other baggages. So let's get into this.
And just one other point, step aside from polling, and I agree with everything you said. Let's just look at the most recent election, 2018. I mean, the kinds of Democrats who won, both in congressional districts and statewide in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan. I defer to you on Wisconsin. You know it infinitely better than I do. But they didn't – I mean, the rap on the guy in Wisconsin, as I recall, was that he was a boring functionary, not that he was a wild-eyed lunatic, right? And the people who got elected, whatever one's criticisms of them could be and probably should be, you know, didn't look like Bernie Sanders, I guess is the way I would put it. Some of them might have looked a little bit like Elizabeth Warren, but they probably looked more like Amy Klobuchar and you know, Joe Biden and sort of conventional Democrats, not many of whose policies I don't agree with or approve of. But so I think people are underestimating. You could have voted Democrat for governor in Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. That does not mean you're a Sanders vote this November.
No, it doesn't. And there's also something very self-conscious about the Sanders movement, which is that they're not really expanding the tent to include centrists. This is not one of those coalition of the decent campaigns. And you can't blame him for everything the Bernie bros do. But as you know, for the last 4 years, we've basically been told, you built this. We don't want you. You're all conservatives. We don't need you people. Why don't you shut up about all of this? And so there shouldn't be a, you know, real surprise if, in fact, many centrists, you know, center right folks don't join this, because, you know, frankly, that's not what this is about. I mean, the Sanders campaign is not about "quote unquote" reaching across the divide or looking for common ground. It's about, you know, 4 more years of revolution.
It's not even about reaching out to Hillary Clinton supporters or Bill Clinton supporters or some cases Barack Obama supporters. I mean, the degree to which he's just willing to trash them. Now, Trump got away with that, and everyone thinks, well, that therefore it doesn't matter. You know, Trump trashed Bush and McCain and Romney, and then the people came home. Republicans came home mostly at the end. But I'm not sure this is a comparable situation when you have an incumbent whom people can stay home, first of all, and people could it's just running a huge risk, just leaving aside the merits of what a Sanders presidency would look like, running a huge, huge and unnecessary risk for the Democrats to nominate Sanders.
Well, one of the arguments that I've heard from one of our friends is that, look, Sanders would not be able to get any of these policies enacted. So we really shouldn't worry about the Medicare for all or the massive spending or the massive tax cuts, because there's just no way that he would have the legislative majorities to be able to do that. And my comeback to that is, one of the things we've learned over the last 4 years is what a presidency without guardrails really looks like, what the executive can do. And this is where I think many of the precedents of the Trump era would really come back to bite conservatives in the behind, because I can't run a list of all the things that, that Bernie Sanders might or, you know, could do using executive orders. I think it's somewhat naive to think that a president as radical as he is would not be able to do a great deal of damage in a relatively short period of time.
And the other thing we've seen in spades over the last 3 years, and you and I have lamented it so many times, is the total capitulation of the Congressional Republican Party to president of their own party. And I guess I've sort of thought that wouldn't happen with the Democrats. They're a somewhat different party. Is Chuck Schumer really going to go along with things that would just gut New York's financial services industry? And is Dianne Feinstein going to go along with things that would seriously damage the biggest companies in California and so forth? I don't know. But, you know, I would not have thought that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and a bunch of chairmen in the Senate and Lamar Alexander and Chuck Grassley would go along with some of the things they've gone along with. So I don't have confidence in that guardrail either. And it's funny, I was having that conversation with a younger person in her 30s. And I guess I was making the argument, you know, probably he doesn't destroy these major industries in America. There are enough people in Congress who would sort of, you know, have a huge interest in defending them. But she pointed out, you know, that's what people said in 2015, 2016 about the Republicans in Congress vis-a-vis Trump. And one can't underestimate if he wins, what kind of mandate he'll have, how much will be intimidated. Maybe they'll check some of the things, but not others. But then, as you say, using executive power, you can then go even further, just as Trump has. So, yeah, no, it's a real, I mean, it's really something I look at with foreboding.
This is one of the argument, of course, is that with a conservative court, that the courts would probably push back and restrain Sanders more than they're willing to restrain Trump. But again, it is rolling the dice. All right, so you have a piece up at the Bulwark, which is an open letter to the Democrats defending their party against the hostile takeover by Bernie Sanders. And, you know, you start off with the good news. Only three states have voted. Fewer than 3% of the delegates have been picked. The bad news, and this is objectively true, a week from now, a third of the delegates, and a month from now, more than 60% of the delegates will be selected. Time is short. I mean, this is the Armageddon will take place much quicker than I think most people have been prepared for. So then you give some advice. What should Mike Bloomberg do?
So the shortest term horizon is South Carolina, which votes Saturday night. The shortest term horizon is the debate of all the candidates, which is tomorrow night, Tuesday night. And as you've seen, these debates do seem to matter. People can rise or be damaged by them. So I think it's very important that I think the only candidate who really has a chance to beat Bernie Sanders in South Carolina is Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Mike Bloomberg is not even on the ballot. And Bloomberg, I think, should run a lot of negative ads against Sanders in South Carolina, finance them directly or indirectly, try to suppress any Sanders momentum into and out of South Carolina. And B, it's much better for everyone if Joe Biden beats Bernie Sanders in South Carolina. Whether Bloomberg would have the nerve to say, he should say, in my opinion, on the stage, he's not on the ballot, right? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't he say, look, I got in late. I'm not on the ballot here. I apologize in a way to the voters of South Carolina for not being in time to be on their ballot. But if I were here, I'd vote for Joe Biden. I mean, I think we need to have mm-hmm. a moderate Democrat. Now, I'm going to contest run against Joe mm-hmm. Biden in the 46 remaining states, but that's my recommendation. So first of all, Bloomberg needs to help out in South Carolina. In my opinion, Klobuchar has no path to the nomination now, and Buttigieg almost none. Mm-hmm. And they might want to have a debate and take their shots, I guess, take a look at a poll on Wednesday or something. But I think they would be nice if they would get out before South Carolina and I think endorse Biden. Maybe if they wait, they certainly need to get out afterwards, assuming they're not in the top two or three. And then I think we go to Super Tuesday, and that's again just for so South Carolina is Saturday night. Super Tuesday is the Tuesday after. A lot of votes have already been cast in some of these states, which is its own both good and bad news in a funny way, because some of them were cast before Sanders had all this momentum. But it's very important that Biden and Bloomberg do well compared to Sanders on Super Tuesday, at least get a split verdict, at least have each of them win a few states, at least have most of the votes not go to Sanders. Proportional representation is our friend at this point compared to the Republicans in 2016. But I do think after Super Tuesday, and I mean like the day after, they need to look at the results, and either Biden gets out for Bloomberg or Bloomberg gets out for Biden. I think if they stay in and keep on dividing the moderate vote, then it gets very dangerous. You can afford to do it. It might be better if it weren't, but I mean, you can afford maybe to go through Super Tuesday with them both getting delegates but the stronger one has to emerge at that point. So that's kind of my simple recommendation. Now, all of this goes against their own self-interest as they see it. It certainly goes against the advice of their consultants who have a big interest in them staying in. But it really is a moment, I think, for these candidates to sort of rise to the occasion.
The Bloomberg campaign, at least online, is really pounding away at Bernie. I mean, they seem to have really opened up some stuff online, including launching an ad about Bernie's record on gun control. But as a couple of people have pointed out, these are only internet ads. They're not the big barrage of artillery that he really needs to do. And I think I saw just a little while ago on the wire Bloomberg saying that so I'm clear I will support whoever the nominee is even if it's Sanders, which I think is somewhat unfortunate as well. What is your take on Elizabeth Warren's strategy, because she is still pounding away at everybody pretty much but Bernie? She took a couple of really very, very soft shots at Bernie over the last couple of days, saying, I'm for abolishing the filibuster. He's not, whatever, but at an event last night, she had a couple of chances to go after Bernie, and she basically pivoted immediately to going after Bloomberg. So what is she doing, do you think? Because, I mean, let's face it, she's a dead woman walking. I mean, after Nevada, I there's no path for Elizabeth Warren.
No, I agree with that. I think she may just prefer Bernie to the moderate candidates. I mean, people, you don't have to impute sort of selfish or bad motives. She is a left-wing Democrat, and she may feel like a Sanders administration is one she could influence. She might have a role in. She'd be a major Senate leader for the Sanders agenda, and that could modify it a bit in accord with her preferences. And I think she's probably just more comfortable with Sanders at this point than Biden or Bloomberg. So I don't think there's much. I don't know how Machiavellian it is. Does she want to be VP and does she want to be Secretary of Treasury? I think it's just that she is closer to Sanders, and that's sort of how. So I mentioned in the piece, I sort of bracket Warren as, look, I'd be thrilled if she says, I'm a pretty fierce critic of a lot of contemporary capitalism, but even I understand that Bernie Sanders is beyond the pale, but I don't really expect her to say that. But I do expect Buttigieg and Klobuchar and either Biden or Bloomberg, all four of them are in the same camp, honestly, and they should see that they're in the same camp, I think, and the sooner the better.
So you recommend very explicitly that after Super Tuesday, either Joe Biden endorses Mike Bloomberg or Bloomberg endorses Joe Biden?
Yeah, I think that would be better.
Is that plausible? Could that happen?
Well, it could happen if one of them is clearly ahead of the other, I think. And maybe if it's close enough, they could each talk themselves into staying in. And Bloomberg has, on the one hand, I'm sympathetic to Biden for just personal reasons and kind of, he's sort of slogged along and not the greatest candidate ever. But, I could live with him, obviously, as president. On the other hand, it may turn out that just Bloomberg's, we don't like in principle the notion that billionaires can come in and buy their way into the race late. And I don't like it in principle. And it's worth thinking about. Changes in our primary system and so forth. But we are where we are, and it may just be in the real world that Bloomberg is a more formidable competitor to Bernie going forward. And if it is, I think everyone has to sort of suck up their gripes and their unhappiness about that fact. If it is a fact, then it's a fact. And people need to fall into line, frankly, because Bloomberg would be acceptable as a nominee. I think he would be a strong nominee, not quite as strong as Biden, maybe, but pretty strong and maybe stronger. And a competent president. God knows I wouldn't agree with him on a bunch of things also. But, look, he's a serious person.
Yeah, he'd be thoroughly annoying, but he's a serious person.
Right.
So the most deplorable of all of the candidates is somebody I don't think we've mentioned yet, Tom Steyer, who actually could play the role of spoiler in South Carolina because he's spending a ton of money in South Carolina. He's on the ballot, and apparently he is leaking some support in the African-American community from Joe Biden. I can't even tell you what the rationale behind the Tom Steyer candidacy is anymore. Why is he in this race other than that he's got all this money and he blew all the money campaigning for impeachment before there was anything on the record?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know him or really what he's up to. He also sounds pretty left-wing, and maybe he genuinely wants Sanders to win, or he's so unhappy with the establishment, the status quo, or he wants to be Sanders, Treasury Secretary or EPA Administrator or Global Climate Change Coordinator or something. I mean, I don't know. But I agree. The amount of money he's spending, I kind of think this is where the debate would also be important for people to explicitly say, and more than one actually say, Tom, you're up here, but this is, frankly, you're not going to be the nominee, and it's ridiculous that people would waste their vote on you. And maybe someone should explicitly say, look, you're targeting African Americans with misleading ads, but at the end of the day, Joe Biden is a serious choice for them, not you, Tom.
Okay, so did you see this poll, this new Siena poll of voters in New York? Fascinating results.
Tell me.
Okay, it shows Sanders leading in New York, but they broke it down, the Siena poll, among Jewish voters in New York. Bloomberg, 28. Buttigieg, 16. Biden, 10. Warren, 10. Klobuchar, 9. Sanders, 6. Sanders, 6% of the Jewish voters in New York in sixth place. And then they asked favorability, favorable, unfavorable. Sanders' favorability among New York Jewish voters, 32% favorable, 61% unfavorable. Trump favorability among New York Jewish voters, 50% favorable, 49% unfavorable. I mean, wow.
It is interesting. I mean, the amount of the percentage of the Jewish vote has gone down so much in New York nationally, too, in recent decades that, of course, it's not clear that New York's not a swing state would make a difference. But, of course, Jews are important as they are some of them wealthy and some of them participate a lot in politics. And so Jewish donors matter. And I do think one question that someone raised with me just yesterday, kind of thinking ahead, someone who's been through a campaign or two, was, will Sanders have the money to compete with Trump? We're talking about the Sanders-Trump race.
Right.
And, you know, it's a – look, again, people – I dislike the kind of notion that we have to be favored by wealthy people and so forth as much as many other people do. But if we want to beat Trump, it would probably be good if the opponent to Trump is as well-financed as Trump. That is one thing Bloomberg will do and can do and will do. And that's really not unimportant. And I think Sanders in particular, though, would be disadvantaged. I think a lot of traditional donors aren't going to – Democratic donors aren't going to be for Trump. A few would be. A few would be nominally for Sanders, but they are not going to go and write the kinds of checks you need to take on the Trump machine, which has been pretty ruthless in extracting money from Republican big donors and also has a pretty big pool of small donors. Now, Sanders will have his small donors, presumably, but I'm not sure you can do the whole thing on small donors. I think he's already getting all of them, and you can see that produces a lot of money, and it could be replicated in the general. You get to have a fresh start, so to speak, and get another, you know, up to $2,700 a person. But on the big super PAC side, I don't know. Does Sanders have the kind of support that the others would have? I'm doubtful. So I do think it's a question also in the general election whether Trump just doesn't, at the end of the day, outspend Sanders enough to make something of a difference.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, a lot of these head-to-head polls that show Sanders being very, very competitive, I don't think really factors in what's going to happen when you have Trump spending $1 billion, you know, touting the good economy and then all of this other stuff about Sanders, because campaigns actually do matter. You know, we were talking about the 1972 campaign and obviously all analogies are flawed somehow. You know, Donald Trump is not Richard Nixon and vice versa, even though there's a lot of similarities between George McGovern and Bernie Sanders. But the analogy that keeps coming to my mind, and I understand the imperfections, the Jeremy Corbyn analogy, you know, what happened in Great Britain, where the Labour Party went with a hard leftist who had a soft spot for surrounding himself with anti-Semites and got blown out in an historic election. And I don't think that Boris Johnson was wildly popular. I don't think Brexit was wildly popular. I don't think the Conservatives were that politically brilliant. But what you had was the Labour Party basically set itself on fire. And it strikes me as that the Corbyn experience ought to have been a cautionary tale for the Democrats in the United States, but it doesn't seem to have registered at all.
No, I think that's really a good analogy, actually, as analogies go. Obviously, you know, the countries are different and so forth. But the Conservative Party had been a mess in governing. It had gone through – Ron Johnson was the third prime minister in, I think, 4 years or five, something like that. They had divided on Brexit. They were divided on economic policy and other things. Johnson had personal, you know, character issues and so forth, and he had deposed the previous leader just within the last year. So there's plenty of reasons to want it. If you came down from Mars and looked at the Conservative Party's governance of Britain over the last several years, you'd say, time for a change. And in fact, there was a lot of that sentiment. And the Labour Party nominated the one person who made it utterly impossible for a huge number of people in Great Britain to vote for the opposition party, for the challenging party. And Sanders is not unlike Corbyn. I think that's a very good analogy. And you could end up, and it wasn't obvious 3 months out, there were people saying, well, you know, the election's a referendum on the incumbent. Maybe, you know, Labour Party with Corbyn could win. And that turned out not to be the case.
So we spend all this time talking about the Democrats and talking about Bernie Sanders, you know, even as we get more and more stories, bizarre stories out of the Trump administration, including their ongoing revenge tour and the apparently rather concerted effort to purge deep staters, which has really been remarkable, including what's been happening with the director of national intelligence. I mean, this is, we keep talking about don't normalize things that go on in the Trump administration, but I feel we have normalized this, that Donald Trump essentially fires his director of national intelligence for telling Congress about the ongoing Russian threat to interfere in the elections, and then putting in place somebody who would be, I would say, a very questionable temperament and qualifications. And yet that's barely registering right now.
No, that's right. He's not just firing career people where he can, but he's also firing sort of not fully on board 100% Trumpy Republicans from important positions. And I think we're ending up in a very bad place. And I think this is only a foretaste of what the second term would be like. And that's another reason why we should not want a second term. We should not want to risk it, which is yet another reason why we shouldn't want to risk a Sanders nomination. So, but I agree, the Trump stuff gets not quite enough attention, perhaps, but it's dangerous. It's unwise. The institutions remain fairly strong underneath, I think. So we tell ourselves, well, Gina Haspel, the head of CIA, Haspel is a serious person, and she's not apparently, she hasn't been fired yet. But again, what does the second term look like? What happens when these agencies really get penetrated in the sense that the people get cleaned out and even the responsible political appointees get cleaned out, which is the current thing they're looking at, I guess. So no, I'm very worried about a Trump second term. We shouldn't let our worry about a Sanders first term totally eclipse that concern either.
No, you can have two just truly horrible choices here. I don't know. At the moment, I'm thinking of writing in John McCain and seeing how that goes. So Bill's piece, an open letter to Democrats defending their party against Bernie Sanders. You can read it on The Bulwark right now. Bill, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks, Charlie. And next time, hopefully, we'll do it in a week and we'll be more cheerful, I hope.
I certainly hope so. I in fact, the odds are in our favor that
it will be better
than today.
Good point.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.